He has the right to remain silent, but not, it would seem, the inclination. So Alec Baldwin, who is not under arrest, is speaking out again. And tonight, his answer to gun safety on film sets is, shall we say, under fire. And then, they could have stopped the show, but didn't. Two mystery people at the Travis Scott concert. Why didn't they end the chaos? And why was the festival staff told to call dead people Smurfs? Plus, it's America's dirty little secret. The third leading cause of death among these young women is murder. So why isn't the crisis setting off alarms? That's all ahead tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. In the aftermath of the very real gunfire and bloodshed on the set of the Western movie Rust, a growing debate is underway on the use of real weapons on film sets, and Alec Baldwin is ready to be heard. The lead actor, who was also one of the Rust producers, spontaneously declared this on his social media accounts, and I quote, "Every film/TV set that uses guns, fake or otherwise, should have a police officer on the set hired by the production to specifically monitor weapons safety." Period. And you may be thinking, isn't there already a person on film/TV sets whose job it is specifically to monitor weapons safety? A person called the armorer. And you wouldn't be alone in your thinking. Actually, quite a number of Baldwin's followers said exactly that. And Alec Baldwin responded, quote, "We had one of those." This is she. You've seen her pictures. Her name is Hannah Gutierrez Reed. You know she's 24 years old with just a single film credit before Rust. And on Rust, she was also tasked with being the assistant prop master, which brings me to a plot twist newly unveiled by the Los Angeles Times. The paper says that in addition to the three people that we know handled the Colt 45 that killed the cinematographer, the film employed a mentor for the armorer, who not only supplied the guns, but recommended Hannah Gutierrez for the job. That mentor, as reported by the Times, is named Seth Kenny, and he reportedly owns a props and weapons rental outfit based in Arizona. Neither we nor the Times could find a photo of him, and Hollywood veterans are describing the job of an armorer mentor to be almost unprecedented. And with that, I want to bring in my first guest, a criminal defense attorney who knows more about Hollywood than most studio presidents do. It's Mark Garagos. Mark, thanks so much for being here. Is there anything problematic about what Alec Baldwin is saying on social media?
Well, let me explain or start with, it's kind of ironic that Alec is out there tweeting basically fund the police, because this is not a really a great thing to do, because when you start kind of going after your weak link, which in this case is the 24-year-old armorer, you're setting yourself up for somebody to roll over on you. And in his position as the as a producer, and it may just be a titular role, but he still is a producer, probably insisted on that and had some control over this and the budget and everything else. It's a very dangerous, dangerous thing. And I don't know who's advising him right now, but if I did, I would tell him you need to sit down and shut up.
Well, so let me ask you about what he did say, because depending on how you feel about Alec Baldwin, and he's quite outspoken politically, so he now has many critics on the right who consider him to be leftist and that his gun control comments may come back to haunt him. There is this notion you could look at the comment that he made two different ways, that she didn't do what she was supposed to do, or we did what we were supposed to do by having a said armorer. Can you see it both ways, or with your legal eye, do you see it only one way?
his audience right now, there's only one audience for him. And this is what his lawyer, and I'm sure his lawyer, is telling him. This is not about your image or reputation right now. You've got one audience, and your audience is a couple of people in the sheriff's office and in the DA's office. And if you say stuff, they're going to use that stuff. And if you think hanging somebody out to dry is a good strategy, let me give you exhibit A, B, C, and D as to why that's not a good strategy. So he really needs to dial it back. This is not a public relations war. This is somebody who died. This is a set that presumably he's the actor who fired it. And he was probably, by all accounts, misled. And that's tragedy. And he must feel awful. And I feel for him. But this is not a time to be worried about public relations. This is a time when you're in the crosshairs, the prosecutorial crosshairs. This is a time for you to sit back and do something else. And that, and I don't know what it is that he does in his spare time, but it certainly should not be tweeting.
So, you know, some of us out here, we're, you know, clamoring for any information that we can get on this, and we're not getting it from the police. You just saw a picture of the police chief in New Mexico who's heading up this investigation. And to that end, are these social media posts actually evidence now in the case?
Absolutely. All of these things come in. They can come in as adoptive admissions. They can come in as concessions. They can come in as showing you had dominion and control. And by the way, if it turns out, I'm saying if, because I don't know, but if there's a situation where he made a decision, there's an email, there's a text, or somebody's going to testify that he said, no, we're not going to spend money on this, and then he's asking for more police on set, that can be devastating to your case, which you don't know what they have. Until you know what they have and you know what the universe of facts is, you shouldn't be making these kinds of statements.
Let me ask you about this armorer mentor named Seth Kenny. You could have knocked me over with a feather, because I thought, we've read all the affidavits, we've heard all the witness accounts that, of course, are public at this point. I know there's plenty we don't know. But I sure have not heard the name Seth Kenny, nor had I heard anything about a mentor for the armorer on this story. So the question I have, legally speaking, does this say that the production is in trouble if they felt the need to hire a mentor for a position that I would think you would be so important in the role of safety that you would be the mentor, you wouldn't be the mentee?
Well, if it turns out, this is another reason you have to be very careful when you, and he's presumably, his lawyers or law firm is doing a parallel investigation. If it turns out that this relationship was a money saving deal, that can be devastating and can lead you right back into an involuntary. There is going to be somebody charged with an involuntary manslaughter. Few things are certain in life, but that is one of them. You don't want to be the person who's charged with involuntary manslaughter. So if you don't want to be that person, be very circumspect about what you're saying until you know what the universe of facts are, because you don't want to say something that later on you're just going to hit yourself like a la Homer Simpson and say, duh, I never should have gone there.
So, Mark, you said involuntary manslaughter, but if the lawyers for Hannah Gutierrez have their way or their theory, they're suggesting there's a murder afoot because they floated this notion that someone must have spiked the box of dummy rounds with a real bullet to sabotage the set. I don't know how much weight that's going to carry as they, you know, look into all of this. But, I mean, let's be clear, there is the potential for something a lot higher than involuntary manslaughter here.
Well, remember, the difference between manslaughter and murder is one element, malice. Now, you can get there in two ways. It can be intentional. You could have a loaded gun. You could fire the loaded gun. That can kill somebody. If it's proven that that was intentional, that's murder. That's a death of another with the requisite intent. But there is a doctrine in the law called implied malice. Implied malice is, you were so reckless, you were so grossly negligent, that we're going to imply the malice necessary to combine with the death to take us to murder. It's not normally as serious as a first degree murder, but it's still murder. So yes, I mean, that's always a possibility. It doesn't seem likely by if I'm handicapping such a ghoulish kind of handicap, but that's something the prosecutors think about. That's something that prosecutors tick through on their checklist of what we're doing.
Let me ask you something that developed, and I find this a very troubling additional aspect to this story. I don't think a lot of people are talking about it yet, but I think they're going to be. And that is that, you know, Alec Baldwin mentioned on the roadside that this thing's over. We're not going to resume production. So it looks as though Rust is done. And then to, you know, further prove that, they started sending in the crews to tear down the set. Mark, and in the teardown of the set, and that's part of the movie. Let's be really clear here. The teardown of the set is part of the movie production. And in that, one of the pipe fitters, a union guy, was bitten by a brown recluse spider. His name is Jason Miller. You might think, okay, so it's a spider bite. They're out in the desert there. But that man on your screen is potentially fighting for his life at this point. He is in the hospital. He is having multiple surgeries, we're told, per day. He has lost a huge part of his arm in many places as they try to catch up with the damage that this brown recluse deadly spider has done. And they're saying that he's now suffering from sepsis. This is another crew member now who is gravely injured. He is more than likely to lose that arm completely, and that's supposed to be a best case scenario, Mark. So we are talking about a movie production that in its waning time may not have had the right medical staff for those who were tasked with tearing it down. Just walk me through what this means.
Well, this is very complicated. First of all, just as a an immediate visceral reaction, people are calling this one of the most cursed sets they've ever seen. But somebody who's had a spider bite that has gone awry, I can tell you it's awful. So everybody's thoughts and prayers should go out to this guy. The interesting calculations, and this is unfortunate, but it's true, that are going on are there are insurance companies that are involved. At least two that we know about in a tower of insurance on this production. If the insurance company made the call to tear this set down, that $5 million tower may be bust. They may be on the line for yet some additional exposure. If, on the other hand, it was somebody else who made that decision, then that becomes even more complicated. And if you don't think those are the kinds of things that they've got lawyers fighting over, you're very naive, because the whole calculus as to whether to tear this set down was done in conjunction with the carrier and whatever the carrier was saying about this, because the carrier obviously or presumably could have staked out a position. We want this thing completed. We're going to try and recoup some of our losses on this. Maybe somebody prevailed on them that's really a cold-hearted calculation. You shouldn't be thinking that way. Tear it down. And if the insurance company made that decision to tear it down, that $5 million cap on the policy may be in jeopardy as well.
I want to put that picture up, if I can, again, of Jason Miller. The whole thing that I just feel as though his story has been eclipsed. And this man, he's pipe fitter. You know, he was tasked with a job that should have been a kind of standard procedure. And there he was with a bite that, you know, started to look bad, ended up in the hospital, and it has absolutely snowballed. And he may end up not prevailing on this. And I just find it extraordinarily sad in an already very sad story. Apparently, his mother has told TMZ, Mark Garagos, that she's preparing a suit with him for workers' comp. And I almost thought, Garagos, come on, workers' comp, is that, I mean, what else can they do? No. What other exposures will there be for them to mine?
No, she needs to get some good counsel, because that's the last thing she wants to do is be capped in that world, you know, which is artificially low. And she should be first things first. I mean, let's hope and pray that he survives this, because this is one of the most horrible things and suffering that you can go through. I'm telling you, I've been through it, not to this extreme, but to even a lesser extreme. I wouldn't worry. I wish it on some of my worst enemies. She needs better counsel, but she should put that aside for right now and concentrate on trying to get him the best medical attention to save his life at this point.
Amen to that. And let me just, you know, I may have called him a pipe fitter. I want to correct that. He is a pipe rigger. He's a pipe rigger and a lamp operator. Jason Miller, keep him in your prayers. He is in the hospital tonight and trying to stave off some of the most serious injuries and potentially a fatal injury. So our thoughts are certainly with him. Mark, can you stay around? I've got a whole lot of questions for you about the incident down in Houston where 8 people were killed at the concert. I've got a couple questions for you. Can you stick around?
For you, Ashley, anything.
Okay, I hope I'm not, like, interrupting your dinner, because I can hear the dishes.
You are. Can you hear the dishes over here? Because they just served. Yeah. If I turn the computer a little bit, you'll see that I've got a whole crew and a table full of people here. But for you, Ashley, you know, for some reason you won't pre-tape. I don't know what that's all about.
It's all about live. It's for the audience. I know you love them, too. Okay, I'm going to come back to you in a little bit. Thank you, Mark Garagos. Grab a bite to eat, and we'll catch you in a little bit. Straight ahead, one of Hollywood's go-to experts on guns, props, and stunts, with some notes on Alec Baldwin's police officer on the set idea. And here's a spoiler. Not a fan. He'll join us next. Welcome back. Alec Baldwin, whose accidental discharge of a hot gun killed one colleague and wounded another, says that movie sets that use real weapons should keep police officers on set to monitor weapons safety. My next guest is Steve Wolf, a firearms expert and stunt coordinator who has been invaluable in helping us learn the ballistics, so to speak, of movie weapons. Steve, thanks again for joining us. I thought of you when I read this on Instagram, and I wondered how many people are going to, well, how many people will agree and disagree, and how many will be able to parse why and why not that's a good or bad idea. So your initial reaction to the idea?
Yeah, it's a really ridiculous idea, and it perpetuates the myth that police officers are firearms experts. Police officers are civil servants tasked with having knowledge of a wide variety of areas, of which firearms is one, and certainly not the dominant one. Most officers in the course of their career will never touch their firearm in a lethal capacity. They are required to go to a range once every 6 months and qualify with 50 rounds of ammo, and that's it. If a Hollywood armorer is trained to handle firearms every single day to be able to distinguish the difference between live rounds, dummy rounds, blanks, and know the safe usage of each, and those things are not at all part of the training or duties or knowledge base for a police officer.
Do you train officers?
I do. And when I train officers, they insist that civilians are not around because they don't want them to see how poor their gun handling skills are.
Wow, there is a revelation. And I guess it's because, you know, if you're doing that every day, if you're handling weapons every day, that just becomes fluid for you. And they're doing a lot of other jobs while they're policing.
That's right. You know, a lot of problem solving, a lot of, you know, tactical issues, a lot of, you know, dealing with people and personnel and a lot of report writing, but not a lot of gun handling, and certainly not handling the types of guns that are used in theatrical environments. Why would a police officer have to know anything about how a prop gun works, how to load blanks, how to manufacture dummy rounds? It's just not their job at all, and not at all an appropriate recommendation from Mr. Baldwin.
It's interesting. You know, once Alec Baldwin says something in social media, it certainly brings out a lot of commenters. And this particular person stood out because he's a writer and a producer and a director. He's a big deal. David Simon, who's behind the hit show The Wire, he wrote this, and I'll quote him directly. Dumb. Having reported on police in my first career, I can assure everyone that the average cop is no more a totem of gun safety than a trained film armorer. The real issue here is that whoever is responsible is empowered and heeded, and already existing protocols are followed. I almost wondered, though, Steve, if there were a police officer on a set, I'm not suggesting there should be, but I'm just wondering if there were, would that chasten people to realize not to get complacent, to do all the protocols, not to just think, ugh, not this again, we do it 1,000 times and nothing ever goes wrong. But if there's an officer there, there's just that added element of seriousness.
Yeah, there's that added element of donuts around, but there's really not an added element of safety. The assistant director is supposed to maintain an air of safety on the set. The armorer is supposed to maintain control of firearms and make sure that they're being used properly. If you hire people who don't have the experience or the authority to command the respect of the crew when they ask for safety meetings or when they make safety guidelines, then you've hired the wrong people. But police officers are not the answer to this.
And they've got this mentor business going on with the
There's no such thing as a gun mentor, a firearms mentor. This is part of the shenanigans that these attorneys are coming up with. And, you know, if you are the firearms mentor on the set, then you're actually the key armorer or you're the weapons master. But
well, let
you don't
me be
hire
clear.
Someone
the, you
in
know,
the
we,
leading position
we
on set
that,
who then has this,
sure, we, you know,
you know, this fantastical entity living somewhere
right.
else that's your mentor.
So we thought that was the case. We thought maybe this was just legal, deflection. But the mentor's actually listed in the production costs. So before there was anything to be legal about, this armorer's mentor was part of the deal. And I just wonder, why do you think there would have been someone, if you're low budget, why would you have to hire two people instead of just hiring one?
You hire one person who knows what they're doing. And if there's more than they can do, then that person chooses a qualified assistant. But you don't have the assistant running the set and then the qualified mentor who knows where. So there's
okay,
a mentee
just quickly,
position.
I want to,
yeah, there's no mentor position. Now, as a department head, it's not uncommon to mentor people in your department. And that's how, you know, young people can come up in the business, learn the ropes, and eventually run departments themselves. But you don't put the least person, the least trained person in the position of most responsibility.
So I want to play for you something that Dean Cain said on this program on Friday night. And Dean is an actor. He has handled weapons a lot in his career. And he also happens to be a police officer. So he knows a lot more than the average guy in Hollywood. And he had a very, very specific point of view. I want to play that for you and ask you on the other side. Take a look.
I think it's important that actors have firearms training. So you know what you're doing. Like it's very difficult for me to point a weapon at someone, even if there's a half inch Lexan between us, like they're supposed to be when you're pointing a weapon at somebody. I can't do that without triple checking the weapon, dry firing the weapon, doing it so many times because I know how you treat every weapon. Even if it's rubber, I don't want to point at anybody. That's you treat every weapon like it's loaded.
Makes a good point, doesn't he, Steve?
He's absolutely right. If actors can learn extensive dialogue, accents, and skills for the parts that they play, they can certainly learn the basics of safe gun handling. They're very simple. I've taught them to 5-year-olds, and you know anyone can do it, and everyone's responsible for doing it.
And they should have many sessions of it as well. Steve Wolf, thank you so much for your expertise. Really appreciate seeing
Ashley,
you here again.
Thanks for having me back.
Still to come, the Astro World mystery. There were only two people, and really just two people, who could have stopped the Travis Scott concert that killed 8 people. So why didn't those two people stop the concert? And then here's another big mystery. Why don't we know their names? More on that in a moment. He opened the concert with a song called Escape Plan, and he closed the concert by saying, "Get home safe." But sadly, before that show was over, 8 people could not escape death at Travis Scott's Astroworld event. The Houston Fire Department now saying that they could be close to figuring out what caused the deadly crowd surge at that concert. The fire chief, Samuel Pena, spoke to NBC's Today show this morning, and here's what he said about what happened.
It seems as though the crowd began to try to push towards the front to get as close to the stage as they could when Mr. Scott's set began. And what was happening is the barricades that were placed in to prevent that surge towards the stage, in essence, caused other areas of pinch points. And as the crowd began to surge and push and compress towards the front, it was those people in the center that began to get crushed, and the injuries started to begin. Now, we're still trying to determine what caused the crowd to begin that surge, but certainly we're looking at everything.
So they know the mechanics of the tragedy, but they still don't know what sparked that deadly forward motion of the crowd. And getting that information could be very helpful in answering another important question. Who is to blame for all of this chaos? The finger pointing began almost immediately after the concert ended. Travis Scott himself, the security crew, the festival promoters all faced accusations. But we now have a lot more information about how the festival was organized in the first place and who really had the power to stop that show. 56 pages of information, to be exact. A security and emergency medical response plan. It was created for the show by the concert promoter Score More. News Nation has obtained the detailed plan, and there are a couple of very perplexing things inside. First, the plan doesn't even specifically address protocols for a crowd surge. All it says is that a festival staff and security should, quote, watch for individuals attempting to arouse the crowd, monitor behavior for escalation. Secondly, it clearly says that only two people have the authority to stop the show, the festival director and executive producer. But neither of them is named. And then the names of the security heads, well, those are those black things that you see scratched out. They're redacted. The third curious thing that we noticed, which is perhaps the most disturbing, is the word that the festival staff and security were supposed to use to refer to people who die. The report says, never use the term dead or deceased over the radio. Notify event control of a suspected deceased victim utilizing the code SMURF. It's not clear why the term SMURF was to be used for a deceased person. I want to bring in News Nation's Brian Enten, who is at the festival grounds. Brian, I'm only going to just suggest that you can guess, you can imagine why the word SMURF was used, but is anyone actually talking about why that sort of degrading kind of language would have been considered for actual dead people? Because there were actual dead people at this concert.
No, everyone that we have talked to does not know why they chose that word. Again, apparently they didn't want to alarm people if there was something bad that happened, which sadly is what happened. They didn't want to use the phrase dead people. So that report instructed the security officers to use the word SMURF. I interviewed a security officer who was at the concert today. I asked him, did you ever hear about this? Were you supposed to use the word SMURF? He said this is the first he's heard of it, but that doesn't surprise me because he basically had no training, and I don't think he really learned anything before he got the job.
Well, I want to throw to a piece of that interview because I found it absolutely illuminating and alarming all at the same time. Let's take a look at this conversation that that Brian had earlier. Take a peek.
So wait, so you show up, they don't ask for your ID, they don't ask for any certification, and they just hand you the uniform?
They and then you ask go for a phone number. But see, that's
they know your name?
They know my name.
Respectfully, do you feel like you were qualified for this situation?
I do. I don't believe I was prepared.
You don't think you were prepared?
I was qualified because I believe that if we were all prepared the right way, that stuff wouldn't have happened the way it did.
Not paid, traumatized. His uncle also suffered either a broken arm or a broken wrist. Has anyone discussed the fact that there are different ways to manage crowds of 50,000? For instance, the Houston Fire Chief just said seconds ago there were pinch points. And we have seen in Australia in particular something called, I think, D-shaped barriers. Do you know anything about these D-shaped barriers, Brian?
Yeah, people have been sending me pictures of these on Twitter all day saying, why don't they have them in America? Basically, at this concert, behind this gate, you just had the crowd all together, smushed together. You played that bite from the fire chief with nowhere to go. In Australia, they started this law where there must be D-shaped barriers used after there was a death at a concert. And you can see from the pictures, it's very clear they have a barrier and they control the amount of people who are allowed in the area closest to the stage. So there's not enough people that close to the stage that they could actually smush each other and trample each other. For some reason, they are not using those tactics at these kinds of festivals here.
Well, maybe they will learn a thing or two from Australia about how to stop the pinch points and allow, you know, deflection points. Brian Enten, thank you for doing all that work today and compiling all those statistics and information. I want to bring back in Mark Garagos, if I can. Mark, let me play for you the Houston Fire Chief and what he said about the performer's responsibility at an event like this. Take a look at this.
You know, the artist has command of that crowd. In my opinion, and this is my opinion right now, because everything is going to be fleshed out throughout this investigation. But certainly, the artist, if he notices something that's going on, he can certainly pause that performance, turn on the lights, and say, "Hey, we're not going to continue until this thing is resolved."
So, Mark Garagos, there's the fire chief saying that the artist could have tamped down everything. And there's also this notion that there's an executive producer and a festival director, two people with the authority to stop the show who didn't. Are they in a heap of trouble?
Well, they certainly are in a civil standpoint. You know, when you're fighting over other people's money, I think there's 20 some odd lawsuits that have been filed. By the time the end of this week, we'll probably have 2,000 lawsuits filed. In a previous life, Ashley, I was a rock and roll concert promoter, and I'll never forget, and had kind of post-traumatic watching this, of a Susie and the Banshees concert where there was a mosh pit and it got out of control. The artist does have an ability to just say stop and to do something. And, you know, there's also been, speaking of Twitter, quite a bit of tapes of situations where artists have done exactly that. Just saw Kurt Cobain, a old clip of him who had seen somebody who was being sexually assaulted stop in the middle of a song, go out there and basically kind of take some action. So the artist has a lot of control. But to Travis Scott's defense, this is a sea of people, and you don't understand, unless you're on stage, what you're looking out at. You can't figure that out. You can't discern that, and you're not actually focusing individually when you've got this kind of sea of humanity. So I don't know that I would be so quick to blame him, but clearly we're going to find stuff out, because there are a whole lot of lawyers and a whole lot of clients who are lawyering up, and this is going to be quite the legal battlefield.
No, I agree. I mean, just look at some of the pictures from above. You think you can imagine what's happening? You can't. It just looks like a big party. And Travis's view is clearly just that. It looks like a giant party. So, Mark Garagos, thank you. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Ashley.
And I want to make sure you get back to your dinner. I know that your family's going to be
mad. I just told a very good story about you at Loyola Law School to the table, and it came. They were regaled by it. You might remember that story. Someday we'll come back and we'll tell it to your viewers, okay? Yes.
One of these days. Well, it's a guarantee that you're going to come back. Thank you, Mark.
See you, Ashley.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears here because this is important. Gabby Petito's dad, he has told me several times, if there is one thing that he wants after the death of Gabby, it is to right the wrongs that he sees every day. Tonight, the missing and murdered women in this country and the stats in one specific community that should bring America to its knees. That's next. The world had been gripped by the story of Gabby Petito, at first missing, then found, and very possibly murdered. Her father says there is nothing that will end his grief and bring her back. But there is one thing he says will help. Pay attention, he says, to the missing and murdered women in Montana who are being ignored.
Native American women are the most stalked, raped, and murdered of any women in America.
They go missing. They're found dead. What's the pattern?
Selena's the 28th one in Bighorn County that hasn't been investigated.
Their voices need to be heard.
If a non-tribal person commits a murder on a reservation, tribal police can't even make the arrest.
Why are these cases not being investigated?
No arrest, no charges brought. It keeps happening over and over and over again.
I feel like I have a target on my back.
We need to stop this.
Joining me now is the host of the documentary, who just happens to be a former criminal prosecutor, Lonnie Coombs. Also with me, the film's forensic expert, Joseph Scott Morgan of Jacksonville State University. Welcome to both of you. Lonnie, I'm going to begin with you. It's a very simple question. These are American women. Why are these murder cases, and I mean, that's the top of the chain in criminal justice, why are they being ignored?
That's right. You know, Ashley, it is a shocking crisis that's going on that I think so many people are unaware of. The reason why it's gone on so long, the numbers are so great and overwhelming, a number of factors. One, our Native American women, for many, many years, the history is systemic racism, discrimination, and sexism. I mean, it started out where the young girls were used as property to barter. And that attitude that they're invisible, that they're not worthy of being protected or looked after, has carried on through the years. There's also a lot of lack of resources for the law enforcement agencies that govern these areas, as well as this jurisdictional issue that is a real problem in these cases. You have tribal lands, and there are tribal police that are supposed to govern those lands. But you also have local police, state police, and federal police. And as was stated in that clip, there's this issue with tribal police not being able to arrest non-Native Americans who come onto the tribal lands and commit crimes. So they have to call for help to the local or state or federal level. And many times when that call for help goes out, it is not responded to. They don't have time. They don't have the resources. They don't have enough deputies to go out there. Or it just falls through the cracks. They're saying, well, where did these girls actually go missing? We don't know. And they start pointing the fingers at each other and no one picks up the case and actively investigates.
So the statistics that we were looking at, they're just really heartbreaking. And then they're also just frankly unbelievable. And that's not hyperbole. So number one, Indigenous women and girls are murdered at 10 times the rate than any other ethnicity. They are two times more likely to be raped. And murder is the third leading cause of death, and that's according to the CDC. Joe, when you signed on to this project, I wondered about the forensics in all of this, and if there's something political in the forensics. I mean, is it different than the average case that you look at?
Yeah, it is. And I think to Lonnie's point, a lot of it comes down to the absence of communication between many of these groups. You have a total and complete breakdown when it comes to accountability. You know, you begin to think about the coroner, you begin to think about maybe a state medical examiner, and a lot of the data gets lost in the mix. And so when you're looking for patterns, particularly from a forensic standpoint, and you've got all of these cases, as you mentioned, that go from reservation to reservation to reservation, there's no way to kind of compile this data relative to typologies, the types of women that are being victimized. If you've got serial perpetrators who, you know, has been pointed out that these women are easily victimized. And a lot of these situations, you've got major interstates that are running right through these areas, which essentially makes them easy targets for human trafficking and for people that would certainly not have their best interest at heart.
When we come back after the break, there is also that question of something that if you hear the word cold case, it means something entirely when it comes to the forensics in these cases, meaning the cold. It's an easy excuse for why someone dies. We're going to talk about that with Joe and Lonnie right after the break. a little bit of breaking news I want to bring your way, and that is that we're hearing news from ESPN that the Green Bay Packers have been fined $300,000 for breaking COVID protocols. This according to the issues with regard to Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers himself, the star quarterback, fined just under $15,000. This has been a really big story, given the fact that that question was, are you vaccinated? Yeah, I'm immunized. No, he wasn't vaccinated. And now that so far is the consequence. $300,000 for the Green Bay Packers, under $15,000 for Aaron Rodgers. I want to return now, if I can, to Joseph Scott Morgan and Lonnie Coombs. So Lonnie, I wanted to just ask you real quickly about the three people that you feature in this documentary, Henny, Kaysera, and Selena. These three victims, what was the similarity between these three victims?
They're all young, 14, 18, and 16 years old. They're all Native American girls that are living in this area of Montana, Bighorn County. They all went out just doing normal things with their friends, going to a party. They disappeared. They're missing. Their families had to search for them. They were all eventually found near the location where they were last seen. And there really weren't any answers given to the families as to what happened to them.
Three lovely faces that we're seeing on the screen right now. Joe, I said cold case before the break. It means something entirely differently from a forensic standpoint and yes. For the reason that it is actually stymieing these cases. What is it? What does that mean when I say cold case with regard to these murders?
Yeah, well, two out of these three young women, their final diagnosis was hypothermia. And that is a diagnosis of exclusion. That means that we got nothing else to hang our hat on. We're going to call this hypothermia, which of course is exposure. The third, they couldn't rule out potentially some kind of suffocation leading to her cause of death. So at the end of the day, as Lonnie had stated, we're no closer to any answers here, and that's very troubling.
And you don't get a whole lot of resources dedicated to you if it's a hypothermia and not murder. That totally changes things. Lonnie, this is so upsetting to see this, but even the granddaughter of the Northern Cheyenne Tribal president was a victim of murder. And it turns out, as I think you've discovered in your research, that almost every Native American personally knows someone who was murdered. And that just seems inconceivable.
The statistics are overwhelming. 94% of our Native American girls and women will be raped or coerced during their lifetime. That means if you are born Native American and you're a girl, you will be raped or coerced unless you're part of that lucky 6%. When we talked to the women there and the families there in Montana, every person we talked to had a daughter, a sister, a grandmother, an aunt who themselves had been missing and murdered. It's everywhere. It's prevalent. And the young girls growing up know that. They know they have a target on their back. And no one should have to live with that level of violence facing them.
Just a quick plug, the documentary Murdered and Missing in Montana premieres this Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on Oxygen. Joseph Scott Morgan, Lonnie Coombs, thank you so much for coming on and talking about, and for doing this project, too. This is really enlightening and very necessary. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Ash.
Thank you.